This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Howdy doody.
Howdy doody.
Who said howdy doody?
Was there a puppet called Howdy Doody?
Possibly. How are you?
I'm well. I always enjoy a good Edism, and we can add howdy doody to the list. How are you? Because you're very busy. We should just explain to people you'll be coming and going on today's episode because you were tackling the energy crisis. So I take it you're pretty busy.
I'm pretty busy. A COP is approaching.
Of course.
So the normal recovery from Labour Party conference didn't really have much process of recovery. Didn't get the conference. Normally there's conference flu. I don't know, did you know about conference
flu? No, I didn't.
Flu.
Well, it speaks well of your immune system.
All that cold water swimming. Yeah, and the temperature is dropping. You'll be interested to hear. It's 14. So the socks and gloves are in a... I seem to have lost my hat.
While swimming?
But
do we need to send divers in?
Actually, I've got a story to tell you about that, which is that I met the chair of the publishing company of Outdoor Swimmer magazine. I was doing a book event in Henley, and I met the chair of the publishing company of Outdoor Swimmer magazine, which, it's a little known fact, began life, it's been going about 10 years, it began life as a magazine called H2 Open.
Ah.
Which the nice man who's a publisher said to me made it sound like a magazine about chemistry. So they changed the name.
I need to ask, did the publisher of Outdoor Swimming magazine,
yes,
offer you a centerfold?
Yes. Well, I think front page, actually.
Front page, and then I think a pull-out poster of you in the aforementioned swimming gear.
There is a dilemma, isn't it? Which is, how do you pose for a swimming magazine? In a suit, I'd say.
A swimsuit.
A wetsuit. Oh, a swimsuit. I'll go modest, I think.
Loosely on this subject, I saw something in the news, and I'm reluctant to bring it up in case it affects your mood.
Okay, go on.
I think this might sting at first, but we'll get into it, and it's going to be okay, right? I saw this on the website of the Doncaster Free Press. It says, Doncaster North MP named as the UK's second least sexy politician, behind only Conservative Health Minister Sajid Javid. Before we go any further, I just want to say this exit poll looks wrong to me. It carries on. It says it was a dramatic fall from grace for Mr. Miliband, who was voted among the most sexy, that's most sexy, Ed, when the poll was carried out last year.
Well, I sort of vaguely remember.
Yes,
that.
I think we talked about it.
Jeff, I think it shows you just can't trust the polls.
I agree. And do you want to know who this survey was conducted by? IllicitEncounters.com, the UK's leading dating website for married people. So this is what adulterers think of you, Ed.
I'm basically falling down the charts with the adulterers, is what you're telling me.
I think they find your good virtue. I think they find that unattractive. I think you should ultimately be complimented.
I mean, I just wonder what poor Sajid Javid has done to offend the adulterers. Right, should we say what we're saying on this saying on the saying on this?
We should.
This week, we're talking about retrofitting our homes. Britain has some of the oldest and least energy-efficient housing in Europe, leaving people across the country with high bills and cold homes. And it's bad for our carbon emissions too. Millions of homes in the UK need upgrading, and a national mission to retrofit them with high-quality insulation and zero-carbon heating could support hundreds of thousands of jobs while reducing emissions and helping us reach our climate goals. We're going to be talking to Josh Emden from the think tank IPPR about the many benefits of investing in a home retrofit programme and what government needs to do. And then to Anika Kelly from Carbon Co-op in Manchester about why they're promoting a people-powered approach to retrofit and what that could look like in practice.
And then our cheerful person, it's like opening a bottle of optimism. It's Matt Woodhead, who is writer and director of Who Cares, which is a play about young carers. It's currently touring the country. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful, maybe I'll even do two, actually.
Oh.
Well, I was at Parkrun on Saturday, and well, actually three.
Wow.
I was at Parkrun on Saturday, and one of the very nice volunteers there shouted out to me, was it a personal best today? Because I listened to the podcast. It wasn't, actually. But then also, somebody in my office sent me a tweet from somebody, which I thought was really rather amusing, which said this. well, it's Jack's microblog on Twitter. Forced myself to do park run, hungover, only to be beaten by Ed Miliband, says in capital letters. I'm never going to recover from this physically or socially.
I remember once coming third in a race of four people on sports day, and that person never recovered socially after being beaten in a race by me.
How did you manage that?
I don't know. It was just one of those weird weird things, you know, like when a superpower descends on someone out of nowhere.
And my other reason to be cheerful, which will appeal to a small section of this of our listenership, is that the Red Sox beat the Yankees in the wild card game. If you need to know more, do send me an email.
And you will get a long blow-by-blow,
boring,
overly detailed email back in response.
Yeah. Although my children are interested, so that sort of satisfies.
Do you trust your own judgment on how interested your children are?
They've got the baseball bug. Okay. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is that my wife is on tour at the moment, which I'm not saying that because I like being home alone, but it's great. It's her first UK tour, and I would love it if any of the listeners to our podcast, if she's coming to a town near you, and she's playing loads of towns and cities, so she probably will be, I'd love it if you went to see her. She's called Sarah Barron. She's very funny. It was her hit show from Edinburgh a couple of years ago. Go and see her. She'll be great. She's very funny.
And when she gets back from you being home alone, which is not really alone because you're looking after Jean.
Yes.
Is she going to get back to find sort of, is it going to be like that Yellow Pages advert? You know,
yes, I've drawn a mustache on the Mona Lisa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We also, I think we can now sort of pull stumps and declare the final end of the vegan cheese making kit, can't we?
Oh, yes. I forgot to mention this. So on Saturday night, I thought, do you know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm going to, Sarah's away on tour. I'm going to make the vegan cheese that Ed gave me for
many
my
years
birthday
ago now.
Or Christmas, I forget which
when,
one.
When I was in my 40s, yeah.
So I got it out on Saturday night of the special place where I've been keeping it.
In the toilet, yeah.
It had expired. So you obviously bought me a vegan, you probably got it in some clearance because it was near its expiry date.
I don't think it was near its expiry date, Jeff. I just bought it many years ago. The thing is, I don't believe those best before dates. I mean, you know, if you were really sort of, in the circular economy, you'd think, oh, never mind, it's only vegan cheese. Well, what could possibly go wrong?
I don't know. I mean, you wouldn't.
Have you chucked it?
Yeah, I didn't want to. I didn't want to take the risk.
Right. So, I mean, the vegan cheese thing is just now. It's like that is we're closing the book on the vegan cheese thing. That's the last time it'll ever be mentioned.
I will be honest with you. One of the big obstacles to, as I'm vegetarian, often think about going vegan. One of the big obstacles to me is that I don't really think they've cracked vegan cheese yet, but maybe I could have been the man to do it.
I mean, just not to put too fine a point on it, you'll never know. I mean, shall I get, okay, here's the thing, Christmas is not that far away. Shall I get you an in-date one for Christmas?
Well, make sure it doesn't expire before 2025.
I'll look for the expiry date.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we are going to get a beginner's guide to retrofitting. We're going to hear about what needs to be done and how it could be done by Josh Emden, who is research fellow at the IPPR think tank. Hello, Josh.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. I feel like I'm moderately confident dropping the word retrofit into a conversation, but in actual fact I've only got the vaguest idea it's something to do with boilers and insulation. So can you give us this beginner's guide, everything you wanted to know about retrofitting homes but were afraid to ask? What is it and what does it involve?
Yeah, sure. I mean those things are broadly right. I think ultimately the end goal is about improving the quality of building materials in our home, making them more comfortable, more energy efficient and lower carbon. And that kind of involves two parts. The first is installing the right kind of insulation to suit your home, making sure that it becomes more comfortable, more energy efficient. And that, you know, lowers your energy usage and consequently that lowers your bills. That's the insulation part. And then the second part is replacing the gas boiler with a lower carbon heating solution. An example which is going to be quite prominent in future is going to be a heat pump. And essentially a heat pump, it's a little box on the side of the home or a flat which contains a refrigerant that transfers the heat from the outside, even when it's cold outside, and it releases heat inside. And that's sort of, you know, seen as a key technology to be much more lower carbon because it uses electricity. And then the final thing, I suppose, to both of these is that lots of people are calling for what's known as a fabric first approach. And all that is just doing the insulation first, because insulation is the thing that's going to be, you know, lowering energy bills and making things more comfortable immediately. But one of the things that we're saying is ideally, you know, yes, fabric first, but ideally you do both of them at the same time, to try and minimize the instances of disruption for the household. And also it decreases the risk that, you know, that the insulation and the low carbon heating are potentially incompatible. So yes, a fabric first approach, but if you can, doing them at the same time. And that's, in a nutshell, I suppose, what we think retrofitting should involve.
I mean, it all sounds like it's important and effective. It also sounds like just an enormous job. I was trying to think, is there any parallel for a project where changes are going to have to be made to pretty much every home, be it authority or social housing or private housing, every home in the country like that? Has that ever happened before?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's interesting because often when we're talking about, you know, the need to kind of fundamentally change the way we're heating our homes, you know, there are historical examples. You know, we did this when we transitioned from town gas to gas itself. I think, you know, that is a similar kind of what we're talking about here. We are talking about, you know, there are 28 million homes in the UK, and almost every single one of them is going to need to have some kind of low carbon heating. That doesn't necessarily mean they all have to have heat pumps, for example. The CCC, the Climate Change Committee, suggests that potentially up to 21 million homes would be having heat pumps. 5 million would be having heat networks, which is essentially pumping hot water through pipes into your home rather than having gas pipes and then a gas boiler. And then there will be some homes in kind of maybe regionally quite specific contexts that might have hydrogen boilers or other kinds of heating. But it is a massive undertaking. And in all of those homes, there's going to need to be consideration of what insulation is needed to make sure that heat pumps or other heating technologies work well with them. It's worth saying that, you know, there is a massive undertaking, but there are, you know, substantial benefits to doing so. And obviously, I'm happy to kind of go into them in a bit more detail.
Well, we should also probably, you know, everybody listening to this will be aware of the role this has to play in tackling the climate crisis. But maybe it would be good just to spell out what a difference retrofitting could make in that context.
Retrofitting from a climate perspective is, you know, is essential to meeting net zero targets. If you insulate your home to reduce your energy demand and then change to a heating system that uses electricity, that is the thing that's going to massively decrease emissions. But in a way, if you're looking at kind of the difference it will make to people's lives, we can almost for a moment, you know, pretend that climate change doesn't exist. You know, wouldn't that be nice? We can just put it out of our minds for a second. And the reason I say that is because the benefits of retrofitting are so substantial that even if there was no climate change, it would be worth doing. And there are, I suppose, four benefits that come to mind immediately. And so the first one is, you know, creating hundreds of thousands of jobs. You know, this is a massive scale of undertaking. So there was a recent Greenpeace study that kind of suggested about 138,000 net jobs across the economy by 2030. You know, substantial job creation figures that could be achieved from this. There's the potential for energy bill savings. So you might see quite a lot of talk about, oh, well, you know, heat pumps might add cost to my home because, you know, electricity is more expensive. Well, it is more expensive at the moment. But even if you just kind of combine insulation with heat pumps, then the bill savings could be quite substantial because heat pumps use a lot less energy than gas, the gas boiler. So electricity prices are more expensive, but it uses a lot less of it, particularly if it's more insulated. The third thing is that, you know, there are more comfortable homes, warmer homes, more comfortable for people. It also has a wider economic benefit to the NHS by saving them money. You know, mouldy, cold, damp homes are associated with respiratory and cardiovascular diseases, and that costs the NHS billions a year. So there's a big saving to be had there. And then the final thing is really kind of reducing dependency on gas. And obviously, in light of recent gas price rises, that's a major issue at the moment. But many kind of low carbon heating solutions will use electricity in increasingly renewable, domestically produced electricity, which means UK households will be protected from those gas price rises more and more. And then you bring back in climate change, and that sets out the timeline and that sets out the urgency by which we need to do all these things that we should be wanting to do anyway.
And you recommend that this takes the form of government investment. I think you've just explained very clearly what we would get back from that investment. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the size of that investment is and why it should come from government, why it should be government leading on retrofitting?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, there is quite a big investment gap. So there's been some analysis done by the Energy Efficiency Infrastructure Group, which suggests there's a gap of about £7 billion investment into energy efficiency and just over £4 billion investment into heat pumps. So there's quite a substantial scale up in investment that's needed. And when I say investment, what I mean by that is largely helping with upfront costs of energy efficiency insulation and heat pumps.
Can you give us an idea of what an upfront cost tip? I know that houses are different, but typically,
yeah. So the Climate Change Committee estimates suggest that it will be just under £10,000 per household on average. I think it's about 2/3 of properties will have efficiency upgrades that cost £1,000 or less, and then they might need to explore a heating solution as well. But for some fuel bore homes, it'll be quite considerably more. For those homes that are going to need to have a lot more funding, you know, one of the things that we're recommending is those homes, those particularly those fuel bore homes, they need to have those full grants because of those costs that are mounting up.
And how common are those full grants? Because even at the lower end, you know, if you start talking about numbers that are more than hundreds of pounds, most people don't have thousands sitting around for this. Does it have to come from the government in the form of grants? Is that the only way to really get this done?
Yeah, so it's interesting. A lot of the industry stakeholders that we've been speaking to have been saying, you know, at the very least, in the first, say, 5 years of any kind of scheme like this, there needs to be public funding to kind of kickstart the market. I think that there is consideration of, you know, how private financing might step in, but really, a lot of this is going to need to be delivered by public funding to get people interested. And I suppose it's worth saying, you know, that obviously we've talked a lot about investment and kind of the cash that's needed, but there are also plenty of other kind of elements to this that are needed. So there's the standards that are needed, the regulation in place that will kind of set the market going. So that's, you know, increasing energy efficiency ratings to a certain level by a certain date, and then similar to how we've phasing out the sale of petrol and diesel cars, that's going to banning the sale of gas boilers. It's also really crucial to be ramping up industry capacities, to kind of setting out a long-term plan in some sense will help to kind of drive demand to train up the workforce. But there also needs to be, you know, financial support to help with training costs, commitments to kind of good quality job standards to make sure that, you know, the industry is actually attractive for people to move into. There's going to need to be kind of massive kind of communication and sort of national advertising campaigns and energy advice services. And then I suppose the final thing as well is capacity for actually local councils to deliver a lot of this. So, you know, having better data sharing, for example, to be able to identify which homes in their wards are going to need to be prioritised because they are the, you know, the leakiest homes.
I want to come on to what the government is doing, isn't doing. Before we do that, how can government nudge people, talk about homeowners really, into this? So replacing a boiler or a heating system, I kind of understand that you could get to a point where you would only be able to replace it with a much more efficient heating system. But with something like insulation, you can't make people insulate their houses. I mean, maybe you could get to a point where you couldn't sell on a house that didn't that wasn't insulated to the right standard. What's the way in getting people to sign up for this?
So I think that's sort of where, if you like, two of the five components come into play. So probably standards is definitely one. So that's kind of one that you mentioned there, which is, you know, introducing standards that sort of say that you wouldn't be able to by a certain date, say, and one of the things that we're considering is 2030 as a date, you know, you wouldn't be able to sell your home if it wasn't a certain level of energy efficiency, or, you know, potentially setting a slightly earlier date for the private rented sector where you couldn't rent a property if it wasn't a kind of certain level of energy efficiency. But then also, you know, in comes the communication aspect of it, which is kind of really advertising, you know, the importance of doing this, the attractiveness of doing so from a kind of perspective of having kind of warmer, comfortable homes. And actually, insulation is, you know, is the key thing which is going to help to reduce energy bills as well. Then you add back in, you know, the cash element, the support for all of this. But I think fundamentally, you kind of need all of these pieces in place, the communications, the standards, and the cash as well.
Talk to us about social housing. How does that fit into this agenda?
Sure. I mean, social homes are really interesting because in general, they tend to already have better levels of energy efficiency than some other tenures. A big part of that was, you know, is that social landlords kind of have an obligation to provide that for their tenants. They show that what can be done from other homes' perspectives. But what it also means is that we can be more ambitious with social homes, and we can demonstrate learnings for other tenures. And it can also, because social homes have landlords that are kind of conscious and making things more comfortable for their home, for their tenants, we can also be trialing things like what's known as the passive house approach, which is a really comprehensive look at the entire home and kind of, if you like, making sure that there's very little heat that can escape at all. And that's a much more kind of comprehensive approach than just putting in a bit of insulation. But the reason why that's really good is that if you kind of trial that and kind of scale that up in social homes, it can help to develop the supply chains for other tenures as well. And as I say, because social landlords are more likely to do that, that can be a really beneficial space to do that.
And just to sort of ask you a slightly leading question, how's the government doing on this agenda?
Yeah, so I think that there's mixed results, but there's a long way to go. So, you know, the Green Homes Grant obviously was scuppered.
Maybe you should explain that to what it was, the Green Homes Grant, to people.
So the Green Homes Grant was essentially a scheme which was offering up to £5,000 for energy efficiency and low carbon heating, and then up to £10,000 for lower income homes. And, you know, it was something that was actually very popular in the sense that demand was very high, but it was administered really poorly. There was far too short a timeline to design it, and it only was intended to last a year or so, which meant that lots of industry players kind of just either weren't interested in it or didn't have the time to ramp up the capacity to get the right number of installers. But the principle of that was good. So we need to kind of preserve the idea of providing grants for people, but it needs to be designed a lot better. In terms of the scale of the challenge, if you like, there's a lot more for the government to do. So, you know, we installed around 36,000 heat pumps in 2020. By 28, we need to be selling 600,000. You know, that's not the total number. That's the annual number. So we need to be increasing that 36,000 year on year, you know, to be in line with meeting net zero targets and kind of get up to that trajectory of 600,000 heat pumps by 2028. We need to be, between now and 2022, we need to be quadrupling the number of heat pump sales. We need to be increasing cavity wall insulation sales by 77%, and then more than doubling the loft and solid wall insulation sales that we're making in this year.
And of course, we're talking a lot about retrofitting homes, but there's the issue of new homes and the standards to which they're built. And it's worth saying, isn't it, that the Labour government had a zero carbon home standard, so all homes would have been built to zero carbon standards. In 2016, it was due to come in and it was got rid of, and we've had nearly a million homes built not to that standard, so in other words, high carbon. Just talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So until there is a future home standard, which is, if you like, the latest iteration of that, which is due to come in by 2025 now, and as you say, it was going to come in 2015, 2016, but it's been delayed. Until that happens, we are knowingly building homes that are going to need to be retrofitted in future. So that's a really kind of key area that we need to be grappling with, because it will just make our lives so much more difficult in future. It will make people's lives difficult as well, because it will be knowingly passing on the costs to them as well.
Well, listen, Josh Emden from IPPR, that's a really helpful summary of some of the things that could be being done. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
How do we get people to do this? How easy is it for you to do this? We're going to speak now to Anika Kelly, who works in the retrofit team at Carbon Co-op in Manchester. Hello, Anika.
Hi, Jeff.
First off, let me just start by saying, tell us about Carbon Co-op. Just lay out what it is and what you do there.
Carbon Co-op, we're a cooperative based up in Manchester. We've been around for over 10 years. Our sort of raison d'etre is supporting people to come together and take practical action on climate change. And sort of about 9 years ago, we decided to really focus that on housing. So over the years, we've really developed our expertise. We've been working with householders in Greater Manchester and beyond to support them to really understand what can be done in terms of the emissions they can save from their homes, what they could do in terms of retrofit and reducing them and retaking that kind of fabric-first approach.
If I'd heard about Carbon Co-op from someone or through the different marketing outreach you do, what do I do? I call you up and I say, listen, I've been thinking my house probably isn't that great. I've been thinking about the climate crisis. I don't know where to start. Can you help me? Is that sort of a typical...
Yeah, it's very typical.
Point of contact. Right, so then where do you take it from there then?
Our approach up until about 3 years ago was to support people to understand the issue, understand the complexity around retrofit, the risks, the importance of doing good quality works well. So we used to do lots of householder-based workshops and then this whole house assessment. So it'd be sort of 2 hours where a trained assessor would come around, make a really in-depth assessment in terms of talking to the household about what they actually want, what their renovation plans, making it sort of work for them, and produce a report as kind of a 40-page report. And we found that whilst that was useful, a lot of people still stalled their projects because they're like, well, I don't know exactly what to do first. I need some more support. I can't find a contractor. I don't know if my contractor is the right one. I'm not sure if it's being installed well. You've suddenly told me about all the risks. Now I'm really worried. And we sort of realized that actually people need more support than that. So we got some funding from BEIS, the government department, about 3 years ago to look at building a sort of local market for retrofit. And what we've done is created an end-to-end householder service called People-Powered Retrofit. Now we provide support right through the whole process. So someone might come up and be like, I really want to do something in my house, I'm not quite sure. We sort of have a half an hour conversation, get a sense of what they're thinking, you know, what their timeframes are like, how serious they are, and then signpoint them to support, sort of help them design a brief, help them get design support, and then help them find contractors. And at the same time, we're supporting bringing new builders and plumbers and architects and consultants into this, sort of supporting them to skill up and meet the demand of householders that we've got. So then we support in the on-site phase, sort of when people are sort of doing the building works, to quality assurance and then evaluation handover. So it's been quite exciting, really, to sort of grow what we do.
Wow. So that sounds brilliant. So I could call you up and say, listen, I live in a drafty terraced house with a gas boiler. You could tell me what I could do, the order in which I could do it in. You can then tell me who could do it so I could feel confident that I was hiring trustworthy people who know about this stuff. And you're helping people in those trades transition to a greener way of working.
Yeah, and supporting them with on-site training too. So, or you might have a builder that you trust and think is, you know, you want to work with who's done your extension, for example, that we could go, well, actually, if you want to work with them, if they're interested in working with us, we're up for doing some training. Because I think that's how, in terms of the bigger picture of change in the construction industry, we really see it as a sort of bottom-up working with local builders to sort of scale up and understand this area and really feel confident to work in it.
I guess 15 years ago, if someone was thinking about doing this stuff, that person was probably a somewhat committed environmentalist who is way ahead of where the average homeowner would be. How much has that changed? Who's the typical person that you hear from?
That was actually one of our reasons to sort of do a more in-depth support, because we found, you know, our membership, who are mostly have been committed environmentalists with a bit of money behind them, were the people kind of pioneering retrofit and really going through very long periods of time working, becoming experts themselves to work out how to do it. We sort of realised that to mainstream this, that isn't, we can't rely on that, which is why we sort of felt that having independent householder advice so people don't need to become experts themselves is important.
We were talking to Josh from the IPPR before about what the government can do. Do you want to talk about to us a little bit about your approach and why you think this people-powered or bottom-up approach to retrofitting homes is so powerful?
We need to sort of mainstream retrofit as the way that we do buildings in this country into the future. And the way that people currently engage with their buildings and their homes are to refurbish them over years. And who do people use when they do that? They go to their local builder. You know, so I think going along with how people already work and sort of supporting that to include retrofit, it's powerful because it's already happening and it's just kind of supporting that to happen in a more environmental way. I think if we have like a kind of top-down, right, we're going to put external wall insulation on all of these buildings. I mean, that possibly if those programs are done well, that'll work, but it has to take a whole house approach. And then when you're working with individuals, you can't really go, right, we're going to do this to your home, because someone's going to say, oh, I don't want you to do that to my home. You know, they're going to say, well, I want to do this to my home. So it's kind of working with what people want is really important. I forgot to say, prepared retrofit, we've had so much demand that we've decided to expand, and we're releasing a community share issue to really grow our service. So if anyone's interested, they can invest for £250.
So I wanted to ask you about this. So you've already raised a significant amount of investments, yeah. More than £200,000, I think. And this is this project, the People Powered Retrofit. So what is this? What are these shares that you've issued? Can you tell us a bit more about it, and like what the idea is and what your ambitions and plans are for it?
The work that we've been doing, People Powered Retrofit, has been sort of, it was piloted through Bayes funding, and we found it incredibly successful, and we've got a huge waiting list of people who want to access the service. And so we thought, well, to expand this, we're going to create a sort of another community benefit society, separate it out from Carbon Co-op, and ask people to invest in the business.
And what will it do for you?
It will mean that we can hire more staff to really meet demand, because at the moment we have had to put a pause on sort of assessments and taking on new inquiries, just because we're sort of dealing with the ones that we've got at the moment.
So we've been talking about homeowners. Is there anything, if you're living in social housing, local authority housing, are you just sort of at the whim of your councillor, or is there anything you can do to make a retrofit scheme happen?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot over the last couple of years. I really noticed the inequality, to be honest, around lots of our membership who are mostly able to pay homeowners and have got a lot of agency and choice over how they improve their homes. And a lot of funded schemes have taken place over the last, 10 years. And quite often those schemes are done to people rather than with them. And there's been problems with those schemes for various reasons, and it is complex. But I've been sort of doing a research project looking at, well, what about taking a people-centred approach to energy efficiency schemes?
And what have you learned about what that could look like and how it could work?
Well, it means resourcing that work well. So it looks like, involving people in the design process if they want to be involved, or making that accessible to them. It kind of involves being aware of people's needs at lots of different stages, and sort of in terms of communication, a lot of times it's sort of, here's a flyer, sign on the dotted line, brilliant, we've got you. It's kind of actually, how do those people actually understand what's on offer? Have you explained it in person? I think it's particularly in terms of what it looks like at the sort of construction phase. Customer service is a massive problem, I think. Like people miss appointments, at the survey stage and at the construction phase.
So they say we'll be here this morning and
then they don't turn up. And then people get really annoyed, and obviously, and things take, months and months to sort out. Like anyone would expect good customer service. It's kind of, unfortunately, there's this attitude that, oh, you're getting it for free, so, we're just not going to treat you well. And I just think that's classist, if I could use that word. I think it's pretty bad.
When you've looked into it, have you seen anywhere? Is there anywhere that sticks out, like a real example, a real place, yeah, where you think, actually, they've done a really good job of it?
Yeah, definitely. There's a brilliant report written by some academics in LSE called Retrofit to the Rescue. And it's all about Portsmouth City Council, who decided to self-fund an NFIT standard. So that's a really high standard of retrofit of their tower blocks, council tower blocks. And they took resident engagement really seriously. Before the design phase, they held open days that people could go into pilot flats. They had access to the whole design team. They could say, actually, we've just enclosed all our balconies. That's where I do my washing. And they've kind of had to change the plans to take in account of people want to, wash their clothes somewhere. And, they actually meaningfully did that. And even though the construction phase was really tough and they still had problems of missed appointments, there was a lot of goodwill for the project from the residents overall. And I know the team in Portsmouth really worked hard to make that work for people.
Well, that's fantastic. And the work you're doing at Carbon Co-op sounds amazing. I would recommend homeowners in Manchester get in touch with you, but it sounds like you've got your plate full at the moment. But the thing that listeners can do if they want to support you in what you're doing is get involved with the investment, which sounds like a fantastic thing.
And also, we've got loads and loads of webinars that we've done that are all free to access for anyone. on lots of issues and technical issues.
Fantastic. Well, Annika Kelly, thank you so much. That's Annika from the Carbon Co-op in Manchester.
What do you think?
I found it incredibly interesting. Before we had the conversations, I was a little bit worried about the size of it, the scale of it.
Yeah.
But actually thinking that just hooking people up to the gas or the electric or the plumbing happened in the past, I think just that my mind was quite blown about the fact that it would affect pretty much every home in the country. And would that be unlike anything we've seen before? And there are some parallels. I was also just really encouraged by how much further the public are along with it. And there is this will to have it done, and people are considering it. And I was really interested in what Josh had to say, in that actually you can think about the climate aspect of it last. There are all these other advantages to sell it to people before you even get onto climate.
I think you're right. And I think it seems to me that of all the green, quote unquote, things you could do, this insulation retrofit thing is like the biggest no-brainer, because it's like, you know, we've got an international gas crisis, and which is playing out particularly in the UK, because we're very, very vulnerable. The best way of managing energy demand is to reduce it, not by telling people to turn off their heat, but by, you know, insulating homes. I mean, the first instance. And we're really rubbish on this as a country. We're just way behind. And, you know, so it lowers people's bills. It helps make us more energy secure. It lowers carbon emissions, and it could create lots of jobs. I think there is a sort of, I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, low-hanging fruit. I don't want to sound like somebody from The Office, but, you know, I do think that this is low-hanging fruit.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And for our cheerful person this week, we're joined by co-artistic director of Lung Theatre and writer and director of Who Cares? It's Matt Woodhead. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming
on. Thank you for coming on. And you're the second director of Lung Theatre that we've had on the podcast, because Helen Monks was on. We were thinking that about 200 episodes or so.
200 years ago.
For anyone who wasn't with us 200 episodes ago, and I think we did sort of cover it with Helen, she was there to talk about other stuff. What is Lung Theatre?
Lung are a campaign verbatim-led theatre company. So we kind of like make work that are based on stories and voices that we believe need to be amplified. And we work really closely with that group. The words that they say in interviews then form the basis of the show. So it could be anything from like, we've done plays with like football fans in Bradford to like 29 single mums taking on Newham Council to Trojan Horse, and looking and working with the teachers and governors that were at the heart of the Trojan Horse scandal. Kind of like banging a big old drum is basically what we do.
And who are you banging the big old drum for with Who Cares then? Because this is an interesting story.
Who Cares is it's a cause that's really, really close to my heart. It's a play that we've been doing since 2016, and it's a story of a group of young carers, four incredible young carers in Salford, Kerry, Antonia Ray, Paige and Kieran. And they're part of like a hidden army of young carers. So there's an estimated 800,000 young carers in the UK, according to Carers Trust. And these are four young people who, you know, day in, day out have been caring for a loved one. And a young carer is basically, you know, a young person who cares for a family member. And that could be like, or a sibling or a relative. It could be because of a disability, a physical disability, mental health illness, or drug or alcohol addiction. I met these young people 5 years ago now, and was just absolutely blown away by their tenacity and kind of vigour and desire to find more young carers and get them support.
And as you've turned that into a your play? Have they followed that story? They've been and seen it. What do they think of what you've done with their words and their stories?
It's been incredible. Well, they've kind of been involved in like all kind of aspects of the production. So it's been done with the Lowry Theatre and Gadam, who support young carers in Salford. And the young people have been involved in like casting the show. So they were casting directors. All of their favourite songs are in there. Like, and originally, you know, as a grown up, you kind of go, oh my gosh, like we're just going to give autonomy to these young people. And we absolutely have done, and they've absolutely run with it. And I think part of the success of the production is that like they've kind of really been in the driving seat of it. It's been amazing to watch them kind of, and slightly like existential to watch them grow with the show as well. So Kieran, one of the young people, got a scholarship to go and do political science at Aberystwyth. Like, wow. One of the other young people has now got a full-time job at the Lowry working in their engagement department. Someone else is just about to go off to uni as well. So it's been incredible to watch them grow as the show has also grown as well.
And you're going around the country, is that right? 15 venues across the UK this autumn. But I think you're also going into schools as well. Talk to us about this.
A huge kind of thing about young carers is that, like, yes, there's an estimated 800,000 in the UK, but a huge amount of them are unidentified. So a lot of them are caring like behind closed doors without any support. So there's kind of, every single local authority has a statutory responsibility to provide a local young carer service. So what we've been doing is, like, in all of the areas that we've been touring to, we've been going into schools. Our fantastic engagement manager, Madiha Ansari, has been delivering like a pre-show workshop that kind of looks at like what is a young carer, and then the young people will then be invited to come and see the performance and have a cool down in the space. And then we go back into those schools to look at pledge making. And I think it's kind of like working grassroots with schools, with students there and also teachers as well, to start making pledges about the really kind of small, simple things that schools can do to actually like support young carers. Already we've been touring this version of the show for about 2 weeks. We've already reached about 600 young people, and already like we're starting to identify more hidden young carers and signpost them to support.
And how do you reach them, Matt, through the process of the play? What's the process by which you get to them?
A main part of it is like seeing the stories of the young people. Like one of them, the pseudonym is called Jade. And Jade was a carer for her dad when he came off his motorbike. And she's also a sibling carer for her brother who has hearing difficulties. Another young carer whose story is featured in the play supports their mum, who has mental health illness and deals with addiction. And I think actually, you can kind of talk about it till the cows come home, and you can kind of like, you know, put on your skinny jeans and do a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation for kids. But actually, like, the thing that resonates with them the most is actually seeing the production and seeing parts of their story reflected back at them. And then they go, oh my gosh, I'm a young carer. And then, you know, we kind of wheel out then a member of the young carer service and then say, well, have you spoken to Pam? Pam can sort you out.
You performed Who Cares in the House of Lords, is that right?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
And how did that go?
Were any of them awake?
Jeff? don't play into stereotypes. How did it go, Matt?
It was amazing. Like, it was really surreal. So the young people went and did speeches, and it was incredible. Like, behind where the way that it was performed, the stage, like, then looked out, and on behind the cast and the young people as they were speaking, they were actually voting. Like, lords and MPs who came would kind of leave and maybe come back. And for me, it was kind of like a bit of a moment where you were seeing kind of people speak about real life, and then there's the decisions, you know, either, I think it was like it was a vote on universal credit that was happening that day. And then you have politicians going and voting on these real issues that, you know, are mentioned in the play and really affect these young people. So it was an incredible day, and it was a real celebration of those young people. But for me, it was in particular kind of like a bit of a stark reminder of actually the power of Westminster, but also the power of these young people to affect change as well. Like, they definitely gave everyone a big kick up the arse. Like, there was no there were no sleeping lords there by the end of that performance. But more than anything, it was just an incredible experience for me to see these, like, you know, four incredible young people from Salford just on the banks of the River Thames in Parliament, like, advocating for the rights of other young carers. And I think, like, that's, for me, that's something that really drives us and gives us fire with this project, which is you've got these four young people who have, in some cases, quite challenging things that they have to balance, like school, home life, drama of being a teenager, you know, also caring for a loved one day in, day out. And you had these four young people who were actually advocating for the rights of other young carers. And that's something that in particular stuck with me.
And the thing is, Matt, you're not just providing testimony of young carers through your work, but you're also advocating certain directions of policy. So tell us about those.
Yeah, because like outside of the play, like we've launched something called the Who Cares campaign. So over lockdown, we've been doing a lot of advocacy work. So a lot of the young carers that we work with in Salford have been on BBC News. We got Hugh Edwards to say the Who Cares campaign. So I did like a little bit of a cry and a mini sick when he did that because it was beautiful. We've been doing things like raising money for young carers who've been facing digital poverty over lockdown. And so getting them laptops and phones and things to kind of make sure they can catch up on education. But also we've launched a working policy group. So in Salford, we've been working with people from like local clinical commissioning groups, people from like the local youth carer service, lawyers, all of those kind of professionals, you know, like actual grown-ups, you know, grown-ups. And then you go, oh my gosh, I'm just a child and you're a grown-up. We've been working with lots of grown-ups and we've been drafting like a series of policies that we're hoping to implement in Salford this autumn. So we've got in schools, for example, we're looking at recommending that there's a designated young carers lead in each school. Policies for local authorities include this idea of a young carer's passport. So if a young carer is identified and known to a service, they can get a card that will make them eligible for, you know, little things that just make life easier, like being able to show your ID card to a pharmacist so they know that you can then pick up your parents' prescription, or you can kind of show it to get a discount on food and, you know, the necessities that you need to care for a loved one. And we've also, the kind of final group that we're looking at is just like health agencies and stuff as well. I think like over the lockdown, like young carers have found that, you know, carers just have reported that 40% of young carers have said that their mental health is worse since the pandemic began. But I say all of this with, like, these are the things that can happen if a young carer is unsupported. And, like, there's a huge amount of positive things that can come from being a young carer as well. Like, young carers that we work with say, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, like, I can cook, I can clean, like, I can, like, pay the bills. Like, how many, like, I can do the laundry. Like, how many, like, adults and grown-ups can say that? And I think as well, like, the resounding thing that we're doing with all of these policies is saying, like, there is actually a huge amount of things that we can do to support them. And it's just about, as a society, just like making sure that every young carer isn't on their own when they're caring for a loved one.
Well, look, it's incredibly inspiring, Matt, what you're doing. People can see where you're going on tour this autumn by going to your website. Really, congratulations from us for what you're doing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. You're all absolute babes. Thank you.
But it wasn't a cry and a mini sick situation.
There was no cry and there's no mini sick during the recording of this podcast, I can confirm.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
We are. How is your quest going?
My quest?
To find out who you were on a date with in November 1997.
I haven't heard. I was hoping for some listener feedback, but no.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Whenever anything vaguely interesting, strange, funny, embarrassing happens, I just think it's just good material.
Maybe a podcast is good for people's state of mind, because instead of something terrible, some disaster unfolding, some embarrassing incident, instead of just being mortified by it, you can straight away compartmentalize it and think, oh, I can use that for a podcast.
Exactly.
How's that going for you?
It's a work in progress. Should we thank our guests?
We should.
Josh Emden and Anika Kelly.
And, of course, Matt Woodhead. Wasn't he brilliant? Emma Corsham produces our podcast. She gets it sounding so professional every week, how she manages it.
Despite my best efforts.
Joel Pierce finds all our guests, does all the research. He is the architect of all this, and he's supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. Ed Seed composed the music, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's lost the adulterer vote.
He never had it.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.